This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, or you can give us a call to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio. Hello there, Colin.
And Neanderthal activist. I did 23andMe. I'm pretty sure I have more Neanderthal DNA than Elizabeth Warren has Cherokee DNA, so... Check your sapiens privilege, is what I want to say.
We may have to go into that a little bit later on in the program. Also with us is Max Reese. He's political reporter for NBC Connecticut and host of Face the Facts every Sunday on NBC Connecticut. We'll learn more about that. Hi there, Max.
Hey, good morning, John.
And Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
Well, let's start with campaign finance updates. A project that Patrick Scahill here at Connecticut Public Radio undertook. We were plugging in some campaign donor information, and we made some of it available on our website at WNPR.org if you want to check it out. Both Democrat Ned Lamont and Republican Bob Stefanowski are investing big sums of their own money into their campaigns, Lamont a lot more than Stefanowski. If you look at some of their individual contributors, though, there's a lot of retirees donated to both men, not just retirees from here, but from around the country. For this project, Patrick interviewed Gary Rose. He chairs Sacred Heart University's Government, Politics, and Global Studies Department. Here's a bit of what he had to say about Stefanowski's donors.
People in the business sector, that seems to be really his base. Small business people, I think, really have been attracted to his campaign. And I would also add that there is, interestingly enough, sort of a kind of a working class dimension to Bob Stefanowski's campaign. I can't say these people are necessarily contributing in large numbers, but it does seem as if it's a combination of the retirees that you said and also people with business backgrounds more for Stefanowski than anything else.
And Colin, I will note that more numbers are probably coming out this week, so we'll get updates to some of these things. But I think a bit of what we are seeing in this, big picture, Ned Lamont has raised money from a lot more individual people at a much smaller donation level. Bob Stefanowski has raised, for the most part, money from people who are giving more than $100. But Gary Rose is suggesting that's a little bit different than your typical Republican might do. He's not just raising all of his money down in Fairfield County from rich folks there. He's raising it from around the state.
Right. It still looks to me as though Stefanowski is having some trouble raising money just generally. I attribute that partly a couple of different things. I mean, we talked about this, I think, last week. He's just never going to be as well networked in Connecticut as some candidates. He's been living in London for a long time. I think also there may be a little bit of a problem for the Republicans. I mean, there's also kind of a period after a primary where you either coalesce behind the candidate or you kind of don't. And this was such an unusual primary season where there's so many Republican candidates who stayed in the field right through the primary. There was a little bit of, nastiness, as there will be in primaries. And because Stefanowski doesn't have a long track record with a lot of these Republicans, it may have been kind of hard for him to get everybody kind of lined up behind him in lots of different ways. But one of the ways this turns up is in the form of money.
Yeah, and Max, what are you seeing here? I mean, obviously, we've heard that he's had a hard time raising money. He's not able to put in as much money of his own as Ned Lamont. Is there a sense that he's been doing better over the course of the last couple of months trying to raise these dollars?
I will say that in speaking with a lot of Republicans, they were pleasantly surprised by the haul he brought in for September, because there were some estimates out there that he wasn't going to bring in more than $500,000. He obviously did much better than that. The problem is, on scale, it's just not that much compared to Ned Lamont. And of course, and we've been over this on this show and you've talked about it a lot, money isn't the most important thing in politics, but it certainly helps. And I think the difference here is that Ned Lamont isn't rich. He's wealthy. And he has an amount of money that is completely foreign to just about everybody in the state of Connecticut. Bob Stefanowski is rich. He is not wealthy. So he does not have the kind of means to just dump another $5 or $6 million into his campaign. And what this kind of feels like, and speaking with some people who've been here longer than I have, kind of feels like John DeStefano a little bit. It's kind of like the candidate who caught the car, spent a whole lot of money to get the nomination, and now here we are, and he's just kind of begging for money from the moment he got the nomination to Election Day.
Danielle, is this Bob Stefanowski needing to raise money while he actually needs to really make contact with voters? Is this one of the things maybe holding back his campaign right now?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think what we have to see is what the outside, interests will pour into this race. You've got the RGA and the DGA. GTA. Those are the two governors' associations for the two parties, and they've traditionally played big roles here. But, you know, this is a year when you've got important elections in Georgia and in Florida and in Michigan and, you know, really important states. Not saying our state is not important, but it's sort of on a little bit of a different scale. And I wonder if, you know, those outside interests are going to be playing in those races and perhaps not paying as much attention to Connecticut this cycle.
On the Democratic side, you have Ned Lamont raising more money from people who are giving $100 or less. You know, he wasn't trying to qualify for the Citizens Election Program. But looking at the numbers, Danielle, honestly, if he'd wanted to, he probably could have run a campaign that would have done that. I mean, what does that say about the type of voter base he's building? Because Ned Lamont doesn't have to worry, like Bob Stefanowski does, about where he gets money to run ads for. But he does need to make sure that people are going to be excited and go out and vote for him.
Absolutely. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, like what Max was just saying, you know, money's important, hugely important. But, you know, can money buy love? I mean, you know, that's what these candidates really
need. I've been told money can't buy you love.
I've heard that somewhere.
I got Colin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what one received wisdom about the Citizens Election Program or any kind of small donation effort like that is it does put you in touch with a lot of people. It's a little bit like people who have to go collect signatures to get on the ballot. You wind up talking at a very retail level to an awful lot of people because you need their small donations. Now, if you do that in a non-off-putting way, I mean, solicit their money, then you wind up with a little bit more of a bond. And obviously, if you give somebody $25, maybe it's a little bit like you bet on that horse. You have a little bit more of an interest. Maybe you'll show up on election day. It can work in your favor. You just have to make sure that you don't make them feel like a lemon being squeezed.
I do want to say, Max, one of the things that Patrick's analysis did, and again, these are numbers from the end of August. We're going to plug new numbers in as they become available, and we're able to put them into the map. But you're actually seeing a lot of money coming from both candidates from out of state. Retirees, the largest by far number of people who are giving. Maybe that's not terribly surprising. But one of the little pieces of information that was interesting is more than half of the money that Bob Stefanowski has raised has come from people out of state. These are big donors who don't live in Connecticut and probably aren't going to vote.
Well, and he has something in common with Johanna Hayes on that, because Johanna Hayes, when she was running for Congress, or is running for Congress, to be more accurate, about half of her money coming from out of state too, which I think is a reflection of where is the maybe energy, where is the actual yearning for Bob Stefanowski to be governor. I found it, first of all, this was incredible reporting by Patrick Scahill. This is like awesome, great data reporting, which gives you an incredible look into where this stuff comes from. But with Bob Stefanowski, and Danielle made a great point, the real support for Bob is financially, it's just not in Connecticut. It's just not. It's coming from the RGA. It's coming from out of the state. And this shows that. But also the retiree point, because both Ned Lamont and Bob Stefanowski, according to the data, got most of their donations from retirees who named their occupation. It's kind of like that ridiculous PSA that's out there about all those elderly folks who are saying, don't vote. You know, they're saying, don't vote because I'm going to vote every time, so you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a funny observation, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things about that big block of retirees is we don't exactly learn very much about where those retirees came from. I mean, retired bankers, retired auto workers, retired teachers are all maybe slightly different people. We did, as we zoomed around the country, find some interesting people, including, as I said in the introduction, a guy in Vero Beach, Florida, who gave to Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani a couple times and gave $100 to Ned Lamont this time.
If you don't get him on your show in the next week, John, that's a disappointment.
We got to find this guy. And another guy, Daniela, who actually gave $3,500 to Bob Stefanowski. What he does is sound design and music for Disney straight-to-video children's films.
Wow.
Yeah, it's actually. So he really likes Bob Stefanowski. You know, so I don't know, this out-of-state money, since Max mentioned it, we wanted to turn over to some reporting that you've been doing too. Johanna Hayes, again, she's raising money, a lot more money than Manny Santos, obviously, which we'll get to. But she's raising money from people here and elsewhere who are excited about her campaign.
Yeah. And again, that can be a double-edged sword. I mean, look at Texas. You know, how much did Beto O'Rourke bring in? $35 million, a massive amount. And, you know, most people are saying he's probably not going to win. So, you know, out-of-state money, I mean, you know, it's great to have money, but do these people vote? And can you translate that into votes? And I think that's the real question.
Of course, it almost doesn't really matter how much money Johanna Hayes raises if Manny Santos doesn't raise any money. And I'm not sure that he's raised any money.
Yeah, it's been a real struggle for all of the Republican congressional contenders. I think maybe he's raised, if I'm remembering correctly, maybe he's raised the most money, but he's raised a very small amount. And, you know, obviously, you know, Republicans running for Congress in Connecticut have real challenges. I mean, three of these people raised no money or reported raising no money, nothing. I mean, in three districts. So it's just a real, real struggle. So, yeah, Johanna Hayes did raise a good sum from both in-state and out-of-state. She's got a lot of advantages. Her candidacy, you know, appears to be fairly, you know, very strong. But, you know, it's just the Republicans are just really struggling.
Reading from your report, $50,000 is what Manny Santos has as of that.
Well, and on the congressional side of things, it is kind of remarkable the lack of success Republicans have had, both recruiting candidates and raising money for them. They can get 30 people, 25 people to run for governor when you know that in the case of running for governor, I don't know, 80% of them, 90% of them were going to be using the Citizens Elections Program.
That's
it's
the
not
difference.
Their money. And so they were all saying, absolutely, I'm going to run. But then you have five people running for Congress, and it almost looks like they either don't know how to raise the money or they're just not willing to make those phone calls after phone calls after phone calls to just call every donor you can to get any amount of money. And that leads to a remarkable discrepancy where Democrats are just crushing them right now.
Yeah, I would differentiate a little bit among some of these races. I actually don't think it makes any sense for the Republicans to try particularly hard to unseat either John Larson or Rosa DeLauro. I don't think you can do it. I wouldn't bother raising a lot of money or tapping out funding sources that could go someplace else. It's just a waste of time. The second district, I mean, Joe Courtney is probably going to be very hard to unseat because he's been there a long time. He hasn't made big mistakes. He's a pretty popular guy. But that district, the composition of that district is such that, you know, if you look even at the 2016 votes, the composition of that district is such that it should be tippy. It has been tippy in the past. We know that it's gone back and forth, Gages into Simmons. There's no reason, and we've had recounts down there. There's no reason why it couldn't be a competitive district. I mean, they've done the opposite. They have made the same decision about Courtney that they made about Larson and DeLauro. And that might be ultimately a smart thing. As I say, he's been there a long time. Long term, though, they should get competitive in that district.
There is no reason under the sun why the race in the 5th district is not competitive. There is no reason. Johanna Hayes is an outstanding candidate. She absolutely is. And Manny Santos could absolutely be a good candidate, but nobody's going to know because he has $50,000, and that's probably enough to pay for gas and basic expenses to drive around the district. That's the problem I see covering this thing.
Actually, $50,000 isn't even enough to really cover a nice night out for the Larson campaign. As we've been reporting over the past 3 months, reading from the Hartford Current, the John Larson campaign spent more than $13,000 at Peppercorn's Grill, $3,600 at Max Downtown, two of Hartford's toniest restaurants, you're right. Maybe one reason, Daniela, for the Republicans to try to raise a little bit more money is just so that they can force John Larson into talking more about this sort of thing. But yeah, when you don't have to spend money on campaigning, you can spend money on nice meals.
This is, you know, in some ways an old story. I mean, I think I wrote the same story in 2012 where we looked at his
dusted off
finances. And, you know, at that point, his spokesman said, well, he's the head of the Democratic caucus and he needs to entertain people. Well, he's really not that anymore, but he still, you know, feels the need to do this. And, you know, there's nothing illegal about it. It's allowed by the FEC and all the, you know, regulatory groups. You know, it's nice to be a congressman when you don't have a competitive district.
Right. And I mean, I noted, and I think it is worth emphasizing, this isn't taxpayer money.
No, it isn't.
This is money that's coming from private citizens
yep.
who've decided to give money to the John Larson campaign for whatever reason. I mean, one thing about John Larson you have to kind of admire is he still is plausibly kind of an Augie and Ray's kind of guy. And I did note, Daniela, in your reporting that Augie and Ray still turns up there.
Yeah, so, for like $35 or something.
He's been known to launch major events and initiatives and stuff like that from Augie and Ray's. And so he still could kind of be that guy, you know, but I think obviously his tastes are probably a little bit more in the realm of peppercorns these days.
Well, when we come back from our break, we're actually going to talk about the woman who now holds the 5th District seat and what she's doing with some of her money. She's not running, Elizabeth Esty. Johanna Hayes is running in her place. Some Democrats aren't exactly too thrilled about how Elizabeth Esty is spending some of the money that she still has on hand. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show, Danielle Altomare, who's State House reporter at the Hartford Current, Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. As a matter of fact, today we're on Facebook Live, and so you can watch us there. We're also here with the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. We're joined by Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, and Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut and host of Face the Facts every Sunday. Congratulations. You've got a brand new show, Max. Tell us about it.
It is. It's very exciting. It's every Sunday at 11:30 a.m. It's a little bit of a different edge, different kind of conversation about Connecticut politics. Sometimes we have a point of view. Sometimes we kind of say something. Other times it's more an interview, holding somebody accountable, saying, what you just said there isn't really true, and here's why, and then we kind of talk about it. Some fact check segments. We think it's a very exciting opportunity for us.
Very cool. So again, this is Face the Facts with Max Reese, 11:30 a.m. Every Sunday on NBC Connecticut. I realize I set that up kind of like Johnny Carson would. I was wondering if we were going to throw to a clip for a second there.
I don't know. Maybe perhaps here, John.
That's very, very nice. And Colin McEnroe is here. Colin, what's on your show today?
We are doing a show today about the future of opera. And actually, a lot of the conversations about opera sound like conversations that are happening out in the electoral sphere in terms of making things more diverse, maybe more relevant. We are actually having a conversation with Nadine Sierra, who's one of the rising stars of opera. She is partly of Puerto Rican ancestry, and she talks a little bit about – I had the conversation with her yesterday. She talks a little bit about representation that way, too. But also, we're talking about sort of ways in which operas are increasingly more and more about relevant contemporary subjects. I quickly want to also mention, and I'll take this opportunity, I have to do kind of a High Sparrow walk of shame here. Last week, I was talking about how Chris Murphy hadn't been all that helpful to state campaigns. The Murphy people got in touch with us and provided extensive documentation. I'm completely wrong. Chris Murphy has been very helpful to state campaigns, ranging from state legislative campaigns, General Assembly-type campaigns, all the way up to Ned Lamont. For all I know, Chris Murphy is like Ned Lamont's Mr. Miyagi. But anyway, Murphy has been very heavily involved. And actually, he and Lamont have a campaign stop today at some senior center. So yeah, I got that one wrong.
Well, that allows us to transition to this next story. You know, Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty said she was not running for reelection. She has contributed $125,000 to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee this election cycle. Some members of the party are a bit perturbed that she's spending from the nearly $1 million remaining in her war chest for some other stuff. What do we make of this, about Elizabeth Esty kind of running, I don't know what they're called, ads or other things? She's not running for reelection. Her money could probably be helping, whether it's Johanna Hayes or somebody else.
Well, there is some speculation, and I don't get this really, but there is some speculation that Elizabeth Esty imagines a world in which in 2020 she might be running for her old seat. Unless there's something about Johanna Hayes that we don't know, or that she bungles her chance in a way that's unanticipatable, I see this as a very unlikely thing. Johanna Hayes strikes me as the kind of candidate who, if she wins this election and gets in there, it's going to be very tough to get out. And God knows she's going to be hard to get out in a primary. And God knows I don't see how Elizabeth Esty could possibly muster enough support to run a strong primary in 2020 against Johanna Hayes. I mean, we're playing chess on a chessboard that's way, way in the future here. But so I confess, I don't understand what's happening right now. I mean, her behavior, as is so often the case with Elizabeth Esty, her behavior often makes you think that you are missing a crucial piece of information. And whatever that piece of information is, like, I don't know why she'd be hanging on to this money right now.
Are we missing a crucial piece of information, Daniela?
How about this, her theory? Chris Murphy resigns from the Senate to focus on his presidential run. Johanna Hayes runs for Senate or gets appointed to Senate or whatever the process is, and then Esty slides back into her old seat. Maybe that's the end game.
Maybe that's good as anything else.
she She already has a fairly contentious, even before this happened, you know, she had a kind of a rocky relationship with many liberal Democrats in the Democratic Party, going way back to the Chris Donovan 2012. And even before that, with the death penalty, there was always it was always kind of an uneasy thing. So, you know, there's not a among, you know, mainstream Democrats or progressive Democrats. My colleague Neil interviewed Tom Swan, and he was just like, no.
Who, by the way, shouldn't be quoted about this. Tom Swan was Chris Donovan's campaign manager running against Elizabeth Esty. Then he goes back to the CCAG, which has this nominal role as a clean elections organization, as an organization, you know, spouting a lot of stuff about ethics and campaigning. Tom Swan has so completely muddied and conflated his role in Connecticut's political picture that I don't see how he can be credibly quoted, especially about Elizabeth Esty. I mean, he obviously has this gigantic conflict of interest.
I think something worth pointing out with a lot of this money is there are limitations on what you can really do with it. You can donate it to charities. You can transfer it to another super PAC. It's really supposed to be used for this race is really how it's supposed to be used. So when we actually saw Elizabeth Esty yesterday and she said, well, I'm going to worry about this in January. Well, when you speak to a lot of the hardcore Democrats who see a blue wave coming and they want to guarantee or at least attempt to guarantee a Democratic House majority in the in January, they're saying dump the money into a super PAC, dump the money into another PAC to support other candidates. Why are you just sitting on this? I think for a lot of Democrats, they think this is selfish. They think this is it's there's an absurdity to this of you're not running again. Get rid of this money and actually help somebody out.
I think that aside from any speculation that we might have about what her future plans are, Daniela, I think it's also clear from anyone who's spoken to Elizabeth Esty since she made her decision to not run for re-election that she sort of feels like she got a raw deal here, that, again, she was forced in many ways to not run for re-election because of a scandal involving domestic violence within her campaign, the way in which she handled it. And I don't sense that she feels like the Democratic Party, I could be getting this wrong, has had her back necessarily, not just the liberal wing of the party.
Yeah, perhaps I haven't talked to her about it. She did have that sort of tweet storm back a couple of months. Remember that? Like on a Friday night where she sort of tried to explain her position and, you know, talked about some of the other things that she had done. But I don't really know. I haven't interviewed her.
I think that we're going to look back on, I mean, number one, we're still going through this reckoning of society when it comes to Me Too, Time's Up, et cetera. But I think we're going to look back on a lot of these 8-month periods and we're going to realize how unbelievably electrified the rail was on these things, where even if you got close to it, that there had to be some kind of an accountability. There are still Democrats screaming and shouting about Al Franken, saying he should have never resigned to begin with. But the Democrats were saying very clearly, as almost like a caucus or a conference position, we're going to be the party that is going to be correct on this, intellectually and morally correct on this. And Elizabeth Esty was, without a doubt, a part of that.
Yeah, I do think that with Esty, I think what happened with Esty wouldn't be good, wouldn't be acceptable in any period. Mm-hmm. I think Max is absolutely right. There are ways in which everybody's become kind of hypervigilant about a lot of different kinds of stories. This story about Esty, where she really kind of concealed this problem.
Actively.
Not only from the press, not only from the voting public, but as far as I can tell, from her own House leadership. Mm-hmm. She had this situation that was potentially volatile and dangerous within her own office. It does not appear that she ever went to OHEC, which is the House office that deals with stuff like this, or to leadership about it. Typically, you would at some point say, hey, I've got a problem here in my office. I've never had to deal with anything like this. Maybe I need to suspend this guy with pay, out without pay. Tell me how this works. It doesn't appear that conversation ever took any place anywhere. She bottled it up.
And found him another job.
And found him
another job.
Without telling
him.
And because piling on is fun here, it's almost like the agreement had goodies in it. Because it did have goodies in it. Paying off a student loan was in this. Like, if you gave that deal to anybody in the private sector, they'd go, okay, I'll walk away, sure. But instead, this was taxpayer money. It was hidden. And yeah, I feel like the sympathy for this is probably a nil.
Okay, let's move on to a big part of the Democrats' strategy to retain control or to regain, excuse me, control of Congress. It counts on Latinos being motivated enough by President Trump's hardline immigration policies that they'll come out on Election Day. There's no guarantee, of course, that will happen, including here in Connecticut. Several folks in the New Haven Independent, also it's at ctlatinonews.com. Colin, have been writing about this. There's a question about whether or not Latinos are going to vote not only here in Connecticut, but across the nation and turn out in the numbers necessary to actually turn things in the favor of Democrats.
Yeah, and I mean, we know from 2016 that there are going to be races. I don't think they're here in Connecticut, except maybe the gubernatorial race here in Connecticut. But there are going to be races where that vote is very, very necessary. And yeah, I mean, I think as was pointed out in one of the articles, and I think was as was pointed out by the politicians themselves, there have been races, gubernatorial races here in Connecticut, where that New Haven vote was incredibly important. Now, what the Latino community is saying is we don't see any representation on the ticket. We don't see any kind of galvanizing rhetoric about this. And I think there's a little bit of fault on both sides. I think on the one hand, yeah, I think the Democrats in Connecticut probably should think a little bit about that. Should be, I mean, Eva Bermudez Zimmerman, who was an insurgent rogue candidate, was the only possibility they had of getting any representation on their ticket. And so that's not a good thing. But that conversation, it can't ever start in, say, January of an election year. It's a conversation that has to take place over years. You have to be in dialogue with a lot of groups, and you have to be figuring out who is the Johanna Hayes of this process. Where do you find her? They did pull Johanna Hayes as a rabbit out of a hat in this particular race. But, I mean, by and large, you need to have that long-term conversation. And I think the Latino community has to, like, really actively participate in this conversation, too. And I think a message of petulance, sort of saying, well, then maybe we just won't vote. That's not how you become politically relevant, saying, well, maybe we just won't vote because you don't have anything to offer us. That's not a good way to become politically relevant. There are better ways to do that.
I will say, Daniel, I've certainly heard anecdotally from a large number of Latino voters, active people in the community and in politics, and also a crossover of all sorts of progressive folks in Canada who do not identify as Latino, who are still feeling burned about Eva Bermudez Zimmerman getting pushed aside by Susan Bisewitz for the potential of being on the ticket with Ned Lamont.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back before the convention speaking with Representative Chris Rosario, head of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, and other legislators, Latino legislators, who were just, you know, astounded that, you know, a state like Connecticut could have a ticket without the presence of a Latino candidate in 2018. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
I think that I will say I haven't done a ton of reporting with the Latino community, but I think there's a larger question of what is the real enthusiasm level for Ned Lamont in Democratic communities and Democratic strongholds. You see some signs in a couple places, but I don't think you're seeing that kind of remarkable groundswell support right now. It very well may be there, and what I'm saying could be completely moot when we get to November 6th and November 7th. But I think that if there is an incredible outreach campaign going on to Latino community or African American community, I don't know if it's very loud. I don't know if we're really seeing it, maybe as much as it was 4 years ago and 8 years ago under Governor Dan Malloy.
One of the things that we've been seeing over the course of this last week, and luckily by the end of the show, we're going to get to some fun things. People cartwheeling, people writing rap songs. But there's also, Max, been a lot of kind of just ugly stuff, including a candidate who's had to drop out of a race for a state house seat because of things he posted on Twitter. Some said a very long time ago, like 6 months ago. This is a young candidate, and he said some incredibly unfortunate things about Parkland shooting victims. Had to drop out of the race, but it's just one of several kind of things that make us feel a little bit like, you know, Trump campaigning comes to Connecticut.
I think that we're also in an age now where a lot of what you say may or may not become a campaign issue. You know, the president called somebody a horse face yesterday, and, you know, that was like the eighth most important thing that happened during the day. The interesting thing, too, about that particular race, talking about the Berlin-Southington district for Joe Arcimowitz, the Speaker of the House, that's a pretty tight district. I mean, I don't know if Joe's going to win. You kind of assume he's the Speaker of the House, he's going to have a good showing. But for his opponent to drop out, and they replaced him yesterday on the ballot before the deadline, you know, that kind of might stunt a little bit of momentum, might give other voters a little bit of pause.
Yeah, and Danielle, I mean, what impact do you think that this has? Because, you know, you see maybe one campaign like this that blows up. There was a lot of blowback toward him on Twitter, and then within a couple of days, this guy was gone. But I don't know if we're seeing more and more of this type of campaigning, if this is just a permanent state of politics, even here at the state legislative level.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, how pervasive it is. Max is right. It was surprisingly close in 2016 with Joe Arcimowicz. You know, he won, but it was not by the margin that you would expect the most powerful man in the House of Representatives to win his seat. So it was pretty surprising in that regard. But as far as the greater ugliness, you know, I'm not sure, you know, can you trace it back to Trump? Is it a more negative time in politics?
But it does raise this question. I mean, if we were talking about whether or not Republicans should go all in on trying to, let's say, unseat a John Larson or try to run very strong somewhere or other, you would think that if you're going to put a good candidate someplace, you might want to try to take out Joe Arcimowicz, right? Mm-hmm. You might actually put somebody there as opposed to a 22-year-old Republican college student who says nasty things about people and racist things about people
mm-hmm.
on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that's the place to spend your money.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I don't know how involved the state party is on some of these seats. And the thing with Larson that's kind of interesting, you would think in some ways maybe Larson's opponent would be a progressive Democrat who says, you know, this is the end of this, you know,
yeah.
This is what I stand for. You know, Larson's obviously a, you know, an old school Democrat, but maybe there's a, you know, Alexandria Cortez, you know, movement there that would ultimately unseat him more than, you know, a Republican at this point.
Yeah, we just don't do that here in Connecticut for some reason. But
it's true.
I, you know, first of all, I think we have to make one discernment here. And so the tradition of name calling towards one's opponent is not new.
Mm-hmm.
And we also understand that just within the course of a campaign, there will be heated exchanges. Beto O'Rourke yesterday really went on at some length about what a big fat liar Ted Cruz is. And he actually cited Donald Trump. He said, Donald Trump called him Lion Ted, and it stuck because it's true. But that kind of stuff, to me, that doesn't seem new. I think the thing that seems new or different is these people who are emerging as candidates. And because of digital media and maybe because of the empowerment that people do feel pre-Trump and post-Trump, people have said things, as you have suggested, that are really, really ugly, not about their opponents, but about other American citizens. And I hate to pick on J.R. Romano. That's actually not true. I don't mind picking on J.R. Romano. But, I mean, you know, he's the Republican chair in Connecticut. He, for a long time, was doing those Whiskey Patriot videos that included Carl Higbee, a guy who got in trouble in the Trump administration for exactly that kind of rhetoric towards various minority groups. I think ultimately, maybe if the Republican Party wants to change its tone, they may at some point want to do a leadership change where they can have a slightly more grown-up tone to the way they're campaigning. And we'll have to see how Mr. Gagliardi, I think his name is, who is the new
Michael Gagliardi.
Yes, the new inserted candidate at the last moment.
I wonder if he checked his Twitter feed from 6 months ago or
somebody
a year ago.
Did.
We'll
somebody
find out.
Did. Yeah.
This keeps happening with Major League Baseball players and other folks who
never tweet.
Not very old, but you go back a year in their Twitter feed and you're like, oh my God, he said that? And I just gave him $5 million. We're talking with Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut and host of Face the Facts every Sunday, his brand new show. Danielle Altamari is here, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. There's some fun stuff to talk about in politics. We'll talk about some of that coming up right after this break in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse, or you can also find us on Facebook Live today. We're on Facebook Live and also on Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show. Danielle Altamari is here. She's a State House reporter at the Hartford Current, and Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. A few things coming up on Where We Live, a really great series of interviews. Lucy Nalpathanchel sitting down with candidates. So tomorrow, Thursday, October 18th, Rod Hanscom, the Libertarian, comes in to sit down with Lucy and answer your questions. Oz Griebel is here on Friday the 19th. next week. Yes, Bob Stefanowski is coming in Thursday, October 25th, to sit down with Lucy. Ned Lamont on Friday, October 26th. And Mark Stewart Greenstein is coming in on October 29th. You can find it all on WNPR.org if you want to see what's happening with Where We Live as Lucy sits down with folks. I'm going to be moderating the next to the last debate. It's being sponsored by the Connecticut Broadcasters Association tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's going to be streaming live at WNPR.org. We're going to be simulcasting it here on Connecticut Public Television and Radio at 7 p.m. A whole bunch of folks from the various television stations will be asking questions of three candidates, Oz Griebel, Ned Lamont, and Bob Stefanowski. And I just got one more thing to plug, and it should be a really fun conversation. On Monday, October 22nd, this is next Monday, I'm going to be on stage with my friend Nelbel Marquez Green as part of the Anna Grace Project. And it's a program called The Courage to Connect. And she invited in Soledad O'Brien, the TV anchor and host, to talk about the role of journalists and how we can foster more connected communities. I'm going to be talking a bit with Soledad about getting into it with people on Twitter, which she has to do all the time. And it is something that people do have to do in this world. So you want to connect with people. And sometimes you also have to do a little hand-to-hand combat on Twitter. So that's happening at one of my favorite places, Central Connecticut State University's Torp Theater, next Monday. And I'll send out more information on Twitter myself. All right. Lots of things to talk about. Before we get into some more fun stories, Colin, let's go to a really kind of a weird story. So Elizabeth Warren has been just dogged by President Trump for years now. He calls her offensive names because once she claimed that she has Native American heritage, she not only didn't let that go, she decided to do a DNA test and release it just a couple weeks before the midterm elections. And it's not exactly being greeted by a lot of Democratic analysts with, the most joy. It seems as though this was a kind of an odd place to put it.
Right. One hears all kinds of different things about this. I just want to back up and say one thing that's always bothered me, which is that this issue about her supposed or Native American ancestry has been an issue in Connecticut well before Donald, in Massachusetts, well before Donald Trump got his short fingers on it. What they used to call her was Focahontas, F-A-U-X. But that's like too subtle a joke for Donald Trump to tell, so he just turned it back into Pocahontas. So, look, she has been bullied about this issue, and she's in a race right now, a race that I think she probably going to pretty easily win, but her opponent in that race apparently had been making this an issue too. So one interpretation is go spit in the test tube and just see if you can make this go away. Now, the results are not that impressive. I mean, the distance of her Native American ancestors is considerable. And what's bothering a lot of Democratic analysts right now is, well, we're 3 weeks away from Election Day. We don't need this issue. It's not a good issue. It's an identity politics kind of issue. It's not our issue, but people are going to talk about it. It's going to seem kind of silly. It seems like you're setting yourself up for a 2020 run. I don't think there's any question that is happening. I think the mistake people are making is thinking that this is going to stick around for 3 weeks. My guess is 2 days from now, we will have stopped talking about this for a very long time.
I think that the way this conversation happened inside the Warren war room, if you will, was some really smart staffer from a really expensive college thought, let's do this, because then when we're right, it's going to be a gotcha. And we're going to get that president because we hate him and we're going to get him. Seemingly to ignore that no matter what happens to Richard Blumenthal over the next 30 or 40 years, there's a segment of the population mm-hmm. that's going to always describe him as stolen valor no matter what.
It won't matter what happens, what he turns
matter.
Up.
It doesn't matter. And it is like they're in this unbelievable echo chamber where they thought that this was a good issue to bring up, when all it did was fan the flames. And by the way, when the Cherokee Nation comes out mm-hmm. and opposes what you just did, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say the Cherokee Nation probably isn't a big fan of Donald Trump, and they feel obligated to say what on earth is wrong with you, come on. Sorry, just come on.
Yeah, absolutely. identity is complicated. I mean, it's not just a matter of DNA. And I think that's what the Cherokee Nation people were saying. I mean, it's, you know, it's a really, really complicated issue. And to try to simplify it, and, you know, she was clearly, I think you're right, you know, that was the idea. We're just going to put this to rest. We're just going to answer this, and that'll be that. And it's way more complicated than that. It's not a matter of DNA. And it's just, you know, so what it did was that it raised a whole bunch of new questions.
Well, and I want to add one, if I may, add one more thing to this. You're going to have 15 Democrats. Probably about 9 or 10 of them in the United currently sitting in the United States Senate. One of them is Chris Murphy, who I'm going to guess is going to be on flights to New Hampshire and Iowa, just because why not at some point over the week after November 6th if he wins. All this did to Elizabeth Warren was throw more doubt. If there ever was doubt, it threw doubt on her. So now if you're a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker or a Chris Murphy or any one of the others, you know, even if you're Joe Biden or Michael Bloomberg, this just gave them more credibility because they didn't do something so silly. They knew something that was so almost patently ridiculous and a poor political calculation.
Yeah, can I say one serious thing about all this stuff? Native American voter disenfranchisement is a real problem in this country. There's a real serious issue here that's not being talked about. They lost a Supreme Court decision that had to do, I think, with their addresses, which often don't correspond. I mean, they often don't even have addresses if they're living in some kind of remote reservation land. They have less online access. There's a whole bunch of ways in which Native American people are disproportionately being disenfranchised from actually voting. That's probably a better thing for us to be talking about.
And a president who hasn't minded praising someone like Andrew Jackson at different points, which is still a sore subject in many Native American communities.
It actually, when you bring up the smart person in the war room who says we're going to put this to rest, it actually harkens back a little bit to the earlier conversation when we talk about, you know, Elizabeth Esty getting out of the race or the way the Democrats handle Al Franken. And I think that this is something we've maybe seen over and over again, Max, which is that the Democrats, to a certain extent, will look and say, okay, well, what's the right thing to do? How will this resonate with people? Will this put this to rest? And in Republicans, especially the Republican Party of Donald Trump, is happy to just barrel right ahead. It doesn't really matter what the truth is. We're going to go win the thing. And Democrats, like Elizabeth Warren, perhaps in this little gambit, are seemingly on the losing end of trying to do what they believe to be the right thing.
The key line you just said there is we're going to go ahead and win the thing. We're just going to go ahead and win. The Republicans for the last 8 years have said we're going to worry about winning. That's what we're going to worry about.
Donald Trump just said on 60 Minutes the other night,
it didn't matter what happened. It didn't matter.
Because they won.
And the Democrats in this case, in Elizabeth Warren's case, they were saying, we need to be right. We have to be right on this. No matter what, we have to be right. Almost ignoring that winning is the most important thing. If you can't win, you can't govern.
But in that particular case, there really is no right.
Now, how do you win? I don't know how you win.
You know, whatever her DNA showed, it's a real misunderstanding of the question of identity. And I think that's where they bungled this.
All right. So we're going to move back to the state of Connecticut. Ned Lamont is seen as the butt of one of several jokes in a rap song created by an Oz Grebel supporter. In it, he's compared to the Simpsons neighbor Ned Flanders and mocked for being wealthy. Here's a little clip of this song.
You think this job will be fun, Ned? Is that why you want it? Just be thankful that you're rich and go buy yourself an island. My land's a quarter acre in a neighboring town. This is our last ship. We can't afford to go down with it. You want a man of the people. Get out your house and vote for Grebel. In his pal, Folkhart, Monty, Python, Pylon. But I got my money on Grebel.
Okay, so before we get into the fact that this may be the most entertaining thing to have come out in the Grebel campaign, and this was, let's just say, an outside a contributor to the Grebel campaign. Colin, as I listen to the song, the little refrain there, the chorus is actually pretty catchy. You know, you want a man of the people, get out of their house and vote for Grebel.
Is it?
And for pal, full card Monty, Python Pylon, but I've got my money on Oz. You end it with Oz. Why would you end on I've got my money on Grebel? That just doesn't make any sense from a musicological standpoint.
You've actually put a lot of thought into this.
That
impresses me and alarms me a bit. But clearly, you need to be playing more of a producing role in some of these. I'll just say this. I actually thought this was pretty good. In a sense, or just to back up, this is kind of the Grebel campaign that could have been. You know, if he'd really been able to run plausibly as an outsider and really kind of pull up a lot of spontaneous, you should pardon the expression, indigenous support with people making, you know, making their own videos and making their own raps and stuff like that. I mean, if he'd been able to run that kind of campaign from the beginning and really attract a following, you know, he'd be in a very different position right now. He'd be a much bigger player in this race. I think it's hard when you're a guy in a suit and your background is basically running, you know, business community organizations and before that banks. It's hard to be that guy. But when I heard that rap, I thought, oh, I could just picture an Oz Griebel campaign that really did have a kind of raucous, boisterous outsider, let's take on the establishment quality to it. It just never really happened.
This is the most exciting thing to happen in this race for governor, and I'm so disappointed that it happened this late. I wish we had this song, you know, I mean, rhyming people with Griebel, the full Monty, all this stuff is great. I wish we had this like a month ago.
I mean, it's not a great, I mean, I think we both
know
it's not
great
a great
song.
Rhyme.
No, it's not.
It's not a great,
but it's a great song.
But it's a pretty good song, and it sort of works. And like Colin said, Danielle, again, this is something coming from the outside, but it just didn't hit early enough to, you know, gin up any real support. He did get 11% of the most recent poll, mm-hmm. which is something a little bit more than he was doing before.
Yeah, and it puts him in the debates, which is key, right? I mean, that's...
And it puts him in that debate that's happening tomorrow, and probably, I think there's one
yeah,
more
the
following
end of the
week
month. Yeah.
at the end of the month, and that does give him a little bit of a shot. So... Thumbs up, thumbs down. You like the song?
Oh, I love it.
You like the song?
Maybe he'll rap it during the debate.
See, that's the
that would be exciting.
What's good about this is that he doesn't have to do it. Mm-hmm. Whenever you have a candidate, sort of the middle-aged white guy candidate who then decides to put on a rap, that's basically the end of everything. Mm-hmm. That's the end of the world as we know it. But I think somebody else doing it for him, mm-hmm. maybe that's a good thing. I don't know, Colin, thumbs up, thumbs down?
I don't think he's keeping Lin-Manuel Miranda up nights. But I thought it was a good thing. I thought it was amusing.
Okay, so there's the Griebel rap. But here's another fun thing, spurred on at least in part by our friend Dennis House, retweeting people a lot. An outbreak of political candidates popping up on social media doing cartwheels. Can you explain exactly why people are doing cartwheels, Colin?
No. I did start with Sherry Cantor. Was
it
she
did.
The first one? Because Sherry Cantor's in the Park Red Parade, and she just yep. suddenly does this. She's the mayor of West Hartford. And it just sort of got going. And I think I was the person who suggested we talk about these two things at the end of the show, because I do think this is a very colorless campaign by and large, you know, and we have these kind of stodgy, wealthy white guys at the top of the tickets. You know, it's just has been not a lot of fun to cover this campaign. And so anybody doing anything that suggests that they don't belong in a mortuary is good.
So the cartwheels, as far as I know, and you guys know more, obviously, but it's three candidates
we got
did
three
it,
cartwheels.
Right? Yes. All women,
yeah.
right? So
yes.
Why aren't men doing cartwheels? Why
can't.
Do men get to be stodgy and women have to do the cartwheels?
Because I have a feeling the consultants who have been hired by the male candidates running for on the Democratic side probably all said, you know what, just don't do this. Let that. Don't show personality. Don't show fun. Just go ahead.
Actually, Griebel Stuff and Eskie Lamont are all going to do a thing where they take a charge in a basketball game where they just like take
outside
the
restricted
and they,
circle
and they fall
yes.
over. Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Dennis House is on my panel tomorrow afternoon for this debate. He may just ask all three of them to do a cartwheel on stage, which I could actually see happening. I would break my leg. That's I mean, the answer to your question, Danielle, is I would fracture something and end up in the hospital for the rest of the week.
But it is an interesting question. I mean, why do you know we saw Sue Hatfield, we saw Johanna Hayes, we saw Sherry Cantor. Those are the only three that I know of. Why are they doing cartwheels and why isn't William Tong doing a cartwheel? I mean, really?
Well, no, it's why do you think that is?
I mean, we're talking about it, and yep. we're talking about it, and it's all women who are doing it, and I don't know. I just think it's interesting.
I would somersault my way through. I think I can give that a try. I just know I just say this. I know I would fail miserably at a cartwheel.
Oh, I would too.
I'd be like Creed in The Office doing my cartwheel with my New Year's resolution.
But Danielle is bringing it back to a serious point about this, Colin, because again, we do have a let's just say we said this before, a lack of very interesting candidates. The male candidates in many of these races do seem to be relatively stodgy. The women who are doing this are women candidates. I mean, does this tell us something particular about politics in America right now?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I did an entire show about Barack Obama's relationship to the game of basketball. And Barack Obama, as most people probably know, pretty serious basketball player, you know? I mean, like, as serious as you can be while being basically in pickup basketball games and stuff like that, had a court put in, all that kind of stuff. I think sometimes candidates who let you know that they're alive in one way or another, whether it's that or Bill Clinton playing the saxophone, or it turns out Bill Clinton was alive in other ways that we probably, you know, should have known about sooner or something. But I think this is a harmless thing. It's a little exhibition of joie de vivre, which we haven't had a lot of. And, you know, I say congratulations and props to the women candidates who can do this thing.
And maybe we'll see more throughout the course of these next couple of weeks. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut and host of Face the Facts every Sunday. Thanks so much, Max, and congrats on the new show.
Thank you, John.
And thanks to Daniela Altamari. She's State House reporter at the Hartford Courant. Thanks so much, Daniela.
Thank you.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Intern Panina Beattie helped out with this program. Carlos Mejia is the one to thank for us being live on Facebook. We are also on CTN, the Connecticut Network, today. You can continue this conversation on WNPR.org, where you can find a bit more information about some of the things coming up. I will just say once again that Lucy Nalpathanchil has a whole series of great gubernatorial interviews coming up. Rod Hanscom tomorrow. That's on Thursday, the 18th. On the 19th, Oz Griebel. Bob Stefanowski on the 25th. Ned Lamont on the 26th. And Mark Stuart Greenstein coming up on the 29th. And you can listen to me tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock as I moderate one of the final two debates that we've got with these gubernatorial candidates. It's being streamed live at WNPR.org. And you can see it on Connecticut Public Television and listen on Connecticut Public Radio tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Whew, that's a lot. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse.